Hello, welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. From Flagstaff, I'm your volunteer reader, Deborah McFadder, with excerpts from Yes Media, a nonprofit independent publisher of solutions journalism. Through rigorous reporting on the positive ways communities are responding to social problems and insightful commentary that sparks constructive discourse, Yes Media inspires people to build a more just, sustainable, and compassionate world. The last time we were together, we were reading an article called Ancestors in Focus by Shawnee Real Bird, first published November 13th, 2024. We had gotten down to the part where she was telling about her ancestors and how she has become a pilot and the things that are important to her still. She says, growing up on the reservation, I heard oral stories from my elders and often questioned where I belonged. Those who existed before me thrived in the harsh mountains of Montana. They survived wars with enemy tribes, followed by genocide and boarding schools, then reservation life, always striving to preserve what makes our Opsaluka hearts strong. There's a photograph of Shawnee Real Bird posing next to her flight instructor. They are standing by a small plane. Behind them, the sky is blue with big puffy white clouds. And he's handing her her certificate, I think it is, or her license, as she passes her pilot exam. In today's fast-paced world, filled with isolating technologies, the way of life that my Opsaluka elders taught me felt out of place. It wasn't until I learned to fly that I was able to merge my modern identity with my ancestral roots. In 2019, I became the first Opsaluka airplane pilot. In the cockpit of a Cessna 172, I find solace with the sky beings who populate my tribal histories. When the plane's altimeter reads 10,000 feet, the same altitude at which my Opsaluka people once sought visions atop mountains, I honor the ability to connect, to have finally found my place among the clouds. As Graybill sets up the vintage camera, I close my eyes, for all great things are felt most fully with your eyes closed. I am full of adrenaline, surrounded by 15 wild horses from the herd of my grandfather, Timber Leader. I know the feeling well. It bounces between the palms of my hands and gathers as sweat along my lips. I trust the horses with the entirety of my being. I take a deep breath and imagine my light expanding beyond me. All the generations of cowboys and medicine women that make up my blood quantum stand behind me. I put my spirit in that moment to be captured by exposure and alchemy. Now we see John Graybill, who is the photographer that was mentioned earlier in the article last week when we started this, and he's an ethnographer too. He develops photos for the Legacy Foundation's Descendants Project in his kitchen studio. The picture is mostly red, but there's black in it too. We can just see a silhouette of his face, and he's holding up one of the pictures that he's starting to develop in front of a light. From behind the camera, I hear Graybill say, "Got it!" And we all breathe again. The feeling from my hands disappears. It now lives within that dry plate image. More than 100 years separate my image from those captured by Curtis. Looking at my photograph next to those of my ancestors, I am unrecognizable to them, and one day I will be unrecognizable to the generations that follow me. Only the contents of our hearts will reveal our creation stories to be the same. A little about the author. Shawnee Real Bird, also known as Horse Across Way by her Opsaluka ancestors, is an indigenous poet and photographer with deep roots on her home reservation on the Crow Nation in southern Montana. In addition to being a storyteller, she is the first pilot from her tribe and the first woman from the Northern Plains tribal region to achieve her level of licensing. Real Bird's photography and poetry reflect the perspectives of her ancestors as she sees the sky in her plane from the same vantage point at which they sought visions in the mountains. Each of Real Bird's creations offers a multimedia portrayal of her experiences in modern Native America, influenced by her ancestors and traditions. She speaks English and Crow. You can find her on Instagram, Shawnee Real Bird. The next article we'll look at is a civilian-led solution to addressing cartels. This was written by Chantal Flores, first published November 20, 2024. The photograph that illustrates this article shows a person with a large black felted hat leaning over. You can tell they're wearing glasses. They have on a t-shirt that's white that has some writing on the back, which is unreadable in this picture. And they are putting posters on a wall. And the posters are each a large headshot or picture of one person with the word desaparecido over them. In August, on the eve of the International Day of the Disappeared, Maria del Carmen Martinez sits alone in the house her daughter Ophelia bought with the money she earned working as an undocumented immigrant at a restaurant in Houston. Beside her is a tarp featuring her daughter's face, which she will carry for hours tomorrow, as she advocates for her daughter and others who have gone missing during a Day of the Disappeared march. Ophelia, then 25, had just moved into her new home in the northern Mexico town of San Pedro de las Colonias when she vanished in 2007. A shootout between law enforcement and the Los Zetas drug cartel occurred that night, but no one knows what happened to Ophelia. Though 17 years have passed, this is the first time Martinez dared to protest her daughter's disappearance. "I waited 2 years to report it," says Martinez. "People were being murdered in San Pedro every day. If you dared to file a report, you risked being shot." Around 9 a.m. the following morning, a group of about 40 mothers begin marching through San Pedro de las Colonias, chanting, "Alive, you took them! Alive, we want them!" Since the Mexican government declared war on drug cartels in December 2006 and deployed thousands of troops, widespread violence has ensued, leading to a surge in homicides, extortion, forced displacement, femicides, and disappearances. Since 2006, there have been more than 470,000 homicides and more than 116,000 disappearances in Mexico. Men between the ages of 20 and 35 are disproportionately likely to be disappeared, though there are regions where a significant number of women have disappeared. San Pedro de las Colonias, an agricultural town in the Coahuila Desert, has officially recorded 106 disappearances between 2007 and 2013 during the conflict between the Los Zetas and the Sinaloa cartels for control of the La Laguna region, a key part of a drugs and arms trafficking route between Mexico and the United States. However, the actual number of missing persons remains unknown. Relatives of these thousands of victims, especially mothers of the disappeared, often called Madres Buscadoras or Searching Mothers, have spearheaded a movement advocating for strategies, laws, and actions to locate their loved ones, seek justice, and prevent future disappearances. Although levels of violence have significantly decreased due to collaborative efforts of the local government, civil society, and businessmen, families continue to fear reporting disappearances due to threats and persecution. In many cases, they have been coerced into accepting the loss of their loved ones. Meanwhile, in the U.S., the idea of attacking Mexico to combat drug cartels has gained popularity, particularly among the Republican elite. Although Donald Trump has repeatedly denied supporting Project 2025, this 900-page policy urges the next U.S. administration to adopt a creative and aggressive approach to addressing drug cartels at the U.S.-Mexico border, which echoes some of Trump's promises to send kill teams into Mexico to assassinate drug kingpins. However, such an intervention could lead to a continued battle against Mexico's most vulnerable without guaranteeing significant impacts on organized crime enterprises or drug trafficking. The legacy of U.S.-funded militarization in Mexico. When the Mexican president Felipe Calderón declared war on organized crime, he received more than $1.5 billion in U.S. military aid through the Mérida Initiative. During Calderón's six-year term, the Mexican military, with U.S. assistance, arrested or killed 25 of Mexico's 37 high-level drug lords. While Mexican authorities have declared the kingpin strategy mostly a success, It has also fueled intra-cartel violence, leading to the fragmentation of the cartels. According to the International Crisis Group, at least 543 armed groups operated in Mexico between mid-2009 and the end of 2020. Fragmentation has also escalated local violence and put citizens, journalists, and human rights defenders at risk as criminal groups diversify their illicit activities, including human trafficking, poaching, extortion, illegal logging, and more. Even searching for the disappeared is a dangerous endeavor. Since 2010, 21 people have lost their lives while searching for their relatives. One mother, Lorenza Cano, has been missing since January 15, 2024. And yet, despite the danger, Martin Villalobos, a spokesperson for Movimiento por Nuestros Desaparecidos in Mexico, a movement uniting more than 60 collectives of families of the disappeared, says these families are still best positioned to understand the operations of criminal groups and facilitate searches for their loved ones. "We've been saying that we families across the country know the territory," says Villalobos. "How does organized crime operate? Not based on the result of a police investigation, but rather from our own experience. This knowledge has cost some of our compañeros their lives." Despite the risks, these families have often exposed varying degrees of collusion between state agents and organized crime that make their work even more dangerous. In 2020, General Salvador Cienfuegos, who was head of Mexico's army from 2012 to 2018 and once the country's Secretary of National Defense, was arrested by U.S. authorities in Los Angeles on charges of participating in an international drug trafficking and money laundering network. After being pressured by Mexican authorities, the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration dropped the charges and released Cienfuegos, who was then bestowed an honorary military decoration in 2023. This level of collusion places Madres Buscadoras in greater jeopardy as drug cartels continue to infiltrate the Mexican state. From local officials to high-level government, silence zones emerge, where reporting human rights abuses and seeking justice becomes too dangerous. Despite the challenging conditions families of the disappeared face, hundreds of collectives continue to lead searches across the country. In Culiacán, Sinaloa, Sabuesos Guerreros, a group of nearly 2,000 relatives of the disappeared, has located more than 650 bodies in clandestine graves. "We have found more than 18,950 charred fragments in water wells and rivers," Maria Isabel Cruz Bernal, founder of the collective, adds. Cruz is the mother of Yosimar Garcia Cruz, a police officer who disappeared in 2017 in Culiacán. She believes the only thing authorities are doing is betting on our deaths to end the search for the disappeared. Through their investigations, Sabuesos Guerreros have identified high-ranking officials colluding with criminal groups. They have urged the government to purge corrupt institutions and authorities as a first step toward increasing trust and transparency, but their demands have been ignored. "There is no security strategy that protects us," she says. You are tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona, listening to excerpts from Yes Media. A civilian-led path forward. In September, Mexico's Chamber of Deputies approved a constitutional reform initiative that would place the civilian-led National Guard under the control of the armed forces. FUNDAR, a center for analysis and research on democracy-related issues, warned that the concentration of power in the state and armed forces has resulted in grave human rights violations that disproportionately affect marginalized groups, exacerbating their precariousness and intersecting with gender and ethnic vulnerabilities. While a direct connection between the surge in disappearances and the country's militarization is difficult to establish, Alejandra Ramirez, a researcher at FUNDAR, says it's concerning that public security remains entrusted to military forces that often operate with impunity. Instead of continuing to bet on the much-emphasized strengthening of state and municipal police forces, prosecutors' offices, and other institutions, it appears that these entities, the military, are being given primary responsibility, Ramirez says. History shows that they have a track record of committing crimes that go unpunished and unsolved. In Culiacan, for instance, videos obtained by the influential daily Reforma show military and National Guard forces shooting at and detaining a man on October 7th. The footage suggests they planned to kill him, but abandoned the attempt when they realized they were being filmed. In early October, Mexico's new government unveiled its strategy to combat violence and crime. Claudia Sheinbaum, Mexico's first female president, said she would not engage in a new war against Mexico's powerful drug cartels. "The war on drugs will not return," she said after taking office. "We are not looking for extrajudicial executions, which is what was happening before. What are we going to use? Prevention, attention to the causes, intelligence, and presence of authorities. Instead of deploying assassination squads to capture drug kingpins, as Trump suggested, the Mexican government wants to strengthen the National Guard and enhance intelligence gathering, similar to the work families have been doing for years. While both countries continue to rely on military efforts to counterattack drug cartels, families are demanding technical and financial assistance to accelerate the search of the missing and the identification of the more than 70,000 bodies that remain in the forensic backlog. As a first step, they seek to initiate a national dialogue with the support of the international community to advocate for their demands against the Mexican government and amplify the urgency of their struggle. Meanwhile, they continue searching for their loved ones, gathering information on criminal modus operandi, demanding preventive measures, and calling for the implementation of real actions. During the march to commemorate the International Day of the Disappeared, dozens of families walked through the quiet streets of San Pedro de las Colonias, breaking a decade-long silence. Many onlookers stood in stunned disbelief, watching the procession. Martinez walked in the middle, holding the tarp featuring Ophelia's face. For 2 hours, Martinez and the other mothers marched, chanting, "Where are they? Where are they?" About the author, Chantal Flores is an independent journalist based in Monterrey, Mexico. She covers gender violence, enforced disappearance, and social justice. Moving into the opinion section, this article, "Our Power Goes Beyond the Ballot Box," by Sonali Kolkatar, first published November 7th, 2024. The color photograph shows a large stone building in the fashion of government buildings that were built in the late 1800s or early 1900s. It's at least 4 stories tall, and the top of it has triangular edifices on the roof. A group of people has gathered around this building, and they are carrying posters. The trees have no leaves on them, but the people were in shirt sleeves. We see 2 women in the forefront of this picture with long blonde hair, and one of them is holding up a poster that we can see that says, "Does anything even matter anymore?" For the past year, we have been strapped into a seemingly never-ending roller coaster of vicious propaganda, vitriol, racism, sexism, queerphobia, and a smug complacency in the face of a bloody genocide. Election 2024 brought the lowest of lows, Donald Trump's wildest, most fascist fantasies manifesting in a parade of hate, and the highest highs, the late-breaking entry of a multiracial woman of color who snagged the Democratic Party's nomination. Vice President Kamala Harris launched a record-breaking billion-dollar campaign amid a tidal wave of young women progressives spurred by attacks on their bodily autonomy. Over and over, we were told this was the most important election of our lifetimes. We, the people, were asked to choose between an apologist for genocide, the specter of fascist insurrection, or a third-party option that had no serious prospects for victory. Along the way to winning the election, Trump and his allies reduced so many of us to objects, to evildoers, to garbage, to the enemy. If we made it through these past months, it was with a sense of nervous hope that the insults and attacks had an expiration date. If we could just make it to November 6th, we could deal with the trauma, heal, and look forward to holding the centrist establishment accountable. Along the way to losing the election, Harris and her backers flirted with A-list celebrities and anti-Trump Republicans, repeatedly shunned Palestinians fighting for their rights, pushed back against demands to hold Israel accountable for genocide, and wrapped it all up with an appearance on Saturday Night Live. With both candidates' approaches top of mind, I began monitoring election results on November 5th. Feeling, to quote one woman I overheard say to another that morning, nauseously optimistic. As I anxiously monitored the New York Times election needle, coaxing it toward the blue-tinged left, I found myself reliving the trauma of election 2016, when that same needle veered suddenly to the red-hued right. So here we are again, waking up in a new chapter of the same nightmare we experienced from 2016 to 2020. Now, as we are still reeling from many months of abuse, we face the prospect of 4 more years of it. We need to understand what has happened and how to move from here. But we also need to take a moment to mourn for ourselves, for our fellow Americans, and especially immigrants, for our Black, brown, and queer sisters, brothers, and kinfolk, for our children's imperiled future, and for our country's fate. In the coming months, we're going to read reams of analyses about why Harris lost the election, the insurmountable polarization our country is experiencing, third-party candidates' spoiler effects, the blind spots and failures of the Harris campaign, political amnesia, whether the nation is ready to elect a woman, and how Trump's voters will regret supporting a demagogue. But maybe it's not even that complicated. In so many ways, our leaders have failed us, and a lot of people are really struggling, immigrant rights organizer and author Silky Shah said on a recent episode of my show, Yes Presents, Rising Up with Sonali. And the easy thing that happens is blaming immigrant communities, when in fact, obviously, we should be blaming those who have put in these policies that aren't helping communities on the whole. Most Americans agree on their basic needs. Good jobs and unions, affordable housing, and so on. They also don't trust the government. Indeed, some of those who picked Trump might have done so because he's promised to burn it all down, while others might be hopelessly invested in racist, misogynist, queerphobic, and anti-immigrant hate, or both. Together, they number more than 71 million Americans, or 51% of the electorate, with increased turnout of Latino men, younger voters, and first-time voters. The rest of us, about 67 million, who picked Harris, either did so holding our nose to keep Trump away from the levers of power, or genuinely believed she was a force for good. It is this latter group that is probably most shocked and perplexed by the election results. Instead of a shift toward policies that prioritize collective care, which could unite Americans, what we got from the two major party political candidates were false narratives that largely fell into two camps. Trump painted the nation as a dystopian quagmire that only a strong man like him could fix, while Harris's campaign was based on the idea that we must preserve the booming economy she and the incumbent, President Joe Biden, ushered in. But in truth, both parties have moved dramatically rightward. According to the investigative journalist and Yes contributor Arun Gupta, one is hard-right Republican Party known as Democrats, and the other is a fascist party, a MAGA party known as Republican. Shah concurred, saying she found it actually really surreal to see how far to the right things have moved and how much Democrats aren't even really advocating for immigrants in the way they were before. Gupta attended Trump's Madison Square Garden rally in New York City that made headlines for its speaker's hateful comments. He saw a different reality than the one being reported in corporate media outlets. You had lots of anti-Palestinian, anti-immigrant bombast, but that is only half the equation, he said a week before the election. What's really going on at those rallies is love and hate. He concluded that Trump supporters are there as much out of hate as they are out of love, and they go there because these rallies make them feel good about themselves. They make them feel good about the country, that they're part of a movement. What if we all seek a love-based movement that prioritizes us over the interest of elites? What if Trump's election is a horrific manifestation of a nation cutting off its nose despite its face? There are no easy answers to these questions, but since we have failed to stave off extremist hate from occupying the highest rungs of power, we know the most vulnerable among us will likely pay a heavy price in the coming years. The rest of us can't give up. Our power and our potential actually goes beyond the ballot box, says Curie Peterson-Smith, co-director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. We need to keep on pushing on all of those levers of power, regardless of who wins, no matter what day, election day, the day after, inauguration day, the day after. We will, we must get through this time by reminding ourselves that most of us want the same things: safety, security, stability, and, dare I say it, love. But how we get there as a nation is a conundrum we must continue grappling with. About the author, Sonali Kohatkar joined YES in summer of 2021, building on a long and decorated career in broadcast and print journalism. She is an award-winning multimedia journalist and host and creator of YES Presents Rising Up with Sonali, a nationally syndicated television and radio program airing on Free Speech TV and dozens of independent and community radio stations. She is also senior correspondent with the Independent Media Institute's Economy for All project, where she writes a weekly column. She is the author of Rising Up, The Power of Narrative in Pursuing Racial Justice, 2025, and Bleeding Afghanistan, Washington, Warlords, and the Propaganda of Silence, 2005. Her forthcoming book is called Talking About Abolition, Seven Stories Press, 2025. Sonali is co-director of the nonprofit group Afghan Woman's Mission, which she helped co-found in 2000. She has a master's in astronomy from the University of Hawaii and two undergraduate degrees in physics and astronomy from the University of Texas at Austin. Sonali reflects on my journey from astrophysicist to radio host in her 2014 TED Talk of the same name. We've reached the end of our time. You have been tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona, listening to excerpts from YES Media. From Flagstaff, I'm your volunteer reader, Deborah McFadder. Thanks a lot for listening.